Hello and welcome to a new series at The Right Dishonourable. We spend a lot of time discussing the mainstream parties and the Westminster Village on the main show, but there are many smaller parties out there with quite different takes on politics that we think deserve more coverage. So in the series, I'll be interviewing figures from some of the fringes, discussing what it is they stand for, how they are looking to build their following, and what they think about the events of the day. First up, I'm talking to David Elston, a deputy leader of the British Pirate Party. I wanted to begin this interview by asking David if he could summarise his party in a few brief sentences.
A lot of people take a lot of brief sentences with it, but the purest one that I've came across is that it's very pro-personal privacy and personal liberties. Those are shouldn't really be infringed upon by state or private company at all. Free speech is really at the core of all that. We can't have any of these debates or talks or conversations or campaigns without free speech. And the copyright issue is obviously where the party has stemmed from. And that remains at our core all the way through, as many different policies and things that we adopt. Copyright is always something that we need to keep at our, you know, our sort of flagship policy, if you like, is to sort of relax copyright and patents and allow creativity and freedom, because those are in a lot of ways are part of our right to expression. Is our ability to sort of create and things.
So a lot of people would say that the internet, as well as bringing a lot of benefits, has actually caused a lot of problems in terms of privacy. How do you actually go about balancing those two things?
Well, the internet is a tool like any other. It will, if you're a person that wants to breach privacy, that's what the tool will be to you. If you also want to protect privacy, that's what the tool will be to you. So I don't think the internet is inherently the problem, but it has enabled those who wish to do bad to do more bad, and vice versa. The level that we're allowed to create now has also flourished. So I would say that risk comes with any sort of new innovation, any sort of new technology that comes along. That has always been the case with any new piece of technology that's ever been given to us. So we can't lock ourselves in and be afraid of whatever may come. We've got to embrace it and make it our own. And you know, of course, there always needs to be precautions, but that should really be down to the individual, how much risk they are willing to take with their data. And it shouldn't be down to government to dictate what they think is safe for us.
David's optimism about the internet is in contrast to the actions of the Conservative government, which since winning the last general election has proposed a range of measures to crack down on extremism online, just as Britain's spies lobby for further powers. I wanted to see what David thought of all this, particularly given the terrorist attacks in Paris last month.
There's a huge variety of different ways we are surveyed. There's obviously things like snooping on emails, telephone, there was the whole phone jacking and phone hacking scandals that went on. But also, I mean, the last figures I saw, there was only one in every 1,000 crimes were solved by CCTV cameras, and we're captured on those every single day by hundreds, especially if you live in the cities. So you have to sort of question the amount of money, expenditure and energy that's being poured into this surveillance, and what sort of result are you really getting from it? There are ways to stop terrorism, and there are ways to sort of incite it. And at the moment, the sort of foreign policy isn't really helping the terrorism situation, and they're sort of using the bad results like we're in Paris, and the results like ISIS, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, all these different groups have always really been around, and they've always used this to justify us to, that's why we need to watch. But it's, these things haven't stopped because they're watching our emails, our phones, or watching us in public. It's never really prevented any of this. So I would certainly make the argument that, is it really solving anything having all of our freedoms reduced? And if it is, what sort of world have we left for ourselves?
Do you think the things that your party stands for in terms of privacy and creativity and copyright has a lot of traction with the public in terms of actually generating votes?
It's always a very unusual one to bring to their attention. At first, they're either consider a very new subject, which personally I found quite useful because they're always heard about. They always hear about the weekly bin collection policy changes or NHS or something that every party is talking about. But when you bring up an entirely new subject that they haven't quite formed an opinion on yet, or that the major parties haven't really caught up with, it allows them to really think for themselves. And most of the time, they tend to agree that our policies do tend to make sense. They don't want someone going through all their privacy, or they don't want massive incarceration rates or sentences for simple downloading of the latest Marvel film. So generally, the reception is quite good. In terms of that translating into votes, I don't think any party is doing particularly well with the votes at the moment. But given we only had about a 1 month campaign down here in Bridgend and no one had ever heard of the party before, every single person I talked to had never heard of us, and we still managed to pull up 106 votes, which landed us in the same league as Tusk and only a few votes behind the Greens and beating the National Front. I think it tends to resonate quite well.
Bridgend is the parliamentary constituency David stood in last May, where he got a similar number of votes to the Trade Union and Socialist Coalition, or Tusk, one of the bigger groups on Britain's left-wing fringe. It also happens to be an area where UKIP managed to gain 15% of the vote, up from 2% at the 2010 election. I want to know if the Pirates could learn anything from the quick rise of UKIP, or even the slower rise of the Scottish National Party.
There are sort of geographical elements to it as well. And with the rise of the SNP, they of course had a lot of benefit from the referendum, where I know we all know that 45% voted yes. And there's always a degree of swing with people on the fence. And then, although 55% voted no, there's going to be an awful lot of that 55% that were on the fence at the time. Now, when the powers in Westminster started to sort of backpedal on a lot of the powers that were going to be devolved to Scotland and started to show that they weren't quite going to follow through with a lot of their promises. And you had all the major parties, I think, bar the Greens, were sort of really fear-mongering. And once people get hit with a fear, they might vote for a moment in fear, but they generally, once they've had time to calm down and think, they consider the other options. And I think the sort of rise of the SNP in a lot of ways was a reaction to the sort of fear panic attempts by the other parties. And they had I wouldn't say, don't regret is the right word, but they certainly wanted to think again about that referendum vote. And that was sort of that manifested then in the large amount of SNP candidates that got elected.
So do you see any applicability of that to your own campaign and what you're trying to do?
I wouldn't say that the recent change in politics is hugely linked to anything we can do in the Pirate Party. Our successes tend to come to the UK a little sort of slower. Like we see we're doing quite well in Iceland. We've got an MP in Germany, MEP in Germany. So this huge copyright success is going on in Sweden. So the UK tends to be partly under the first past the post system and other things, tends to be a little slower to adopt this sort of piracy view. I wouldn't say the current state of politics in the UK is really benefiting or hurting us in the same way as the other parties, aside the fact that we were able to get more candidates in the general election and more people are looking for the alternative. But beyond that, I wouldn't say it's either way.
So in terms of the International Pirate Party, do you see yourself as part of that bigger party, or is it more a loose kind of grouping of independent parties?
It's a more sort of loose collective where we talk to one another and we'll help one another out, but we're not directly affiliated. We have to have different policies for different countries because our copyright and free speech laws and situations are very different in the different countries. There's a sort of people's sort of charter in Sweden and some other countries that we could run on a platform of having that, but it wouldn't be any use to them because they already have it. So in terms of sort of helping each other out and looking at each other's campaigns and opening a dialogue. I think we're speaking with the Pirate Party in New Zealand not too long ago. And we occasionally open a dialogue with Pirate Party International and the ones in the States. But it's useful to see where each other are and which way the waves of copyright relaxation are going to go. But we're not, in the UK at least, we're not directly affiliated. There is sort of umbrella groups like Pirate Party International or Pirate Parties United and different things. We've elected not to be a part of those because for us it's not hugely useful. But those on the continent tend to find it more useful to be a part of things like Pirate Party EU. So you should have these relationships as long as they are useful to one another.
Larger parties can rely on generous donors and staff with decades of campaigning experience to win them votes at general elections. So what do the pirates do?
The most effect is usually just talking to the constituents when it comes to translating into votes. I was very late joining the general election campaign, and I didn't manage to get a single hard copy paper leaflet out. But I did get 106 votes, which was on par, more or less, certainly in vote share, with a lot of other candidates, both in my own party and outside of it, and beat a few in other parties that did get masses of leaflets out, simply because if someone either telephoned me, emailed me, wrote me a letter, or spoke to them in the street or at any sort of local event, is I gave them an answer, and I didn't give them some sort of script answer. I treated every new question as new as I could and spoke to that person sort of one-on-one. Now, it's incredibly time-consuming, but it does work. It is the most effective way I've found. There is, of course, other things you could do, like radio events, newspaper articles. Those were quite useful as well. But that, to some degree, is almost always out of your control, whether the local papers or whatnot will consider you relevant or not.
Do you think this, the kind of authenticity that you spoke to just now, is that becoming more important in politics? And do you think the kind of professionalisation of politics will go into reverse over the next couple of years?
I certainly hope it does. There's definitely a degree, I mean, it's been growing for a long time, but it's only started to tip, I would say, very recently, where people are tired of the script answers, they're tired of the sort of salesman approach that a lot of politicians take. I think we saw in the last, not just the last Labour election, but the one before that, where Ed Miliband got elected, was everyone was almost sort of pitching a sale. They were trying to bid for something. And whereas that sort of worked before and people were buying into it, and even when it wasn't sort of working, but there was no other choice, people are starting to give alternatives now. And I think that really struck home in the last general election with the vote share. Unfortunately, being trapped in the first-past-the-post system and with the way a lot of the larger parties sort of swarmed areas, even where they wouldn't get any elected candidates, it did harm any sort of real representation in Parliament. So I'd say, yes, it does affect votes, but whether that really produces anything in terms of MPs at the moment really relies on the system we've got.
A common criticism of smaller political parties is that they are glorified pressure groups. So I asked David whether the Pirates aim to be just a campaigning force or a party capable of winning elections.
Yes, to all of them, really. There is as much as a movement, and a campaign group, and a think tank, and a pressure group in it. Inevitably, it is a political party. It does have to stand on certain platforms and contest elections and votes to show the other parties that if they don't start taking these things seriously, we will take votes from them. And that's, you know, one of the things we tend to come across is people say, well, you're too small to really get anywhere. A vote to you is wasted. And people were saying that to the Labour, and they were saying it to the Greens. And now they've said it to sort of Tusk and other parties and ourselves. So, and when you start out, you always come against that resistance and sort of hesitance for people to vote for the alternative. But it does send the message that people do, you know, and add to the pressure that they do, you know, the old powers in Westminster really need to catch up with sort of copyright and free speech and those sorts of issues.
So what are you hoping to achieve over the course of the next Parliament in terms of membership numbers and even potential seats and on councils and that sort of thing?
Yeah, active internal members are definitely one of our biggest goals that we need at the moment. It's a funny situation. You always need more active people to bring in more members and money, to bring in more active people, to bring in more members and money. So, but the biggest thing we've always struggled on, even long before I was even in the party, the common complaint was we have too few active people doing what we need to sort of talk about. So there you can manage that to a degree where our press releases are getting out and our consultation replies and things are being posted online and that sort of thing, where you can kind of blanket reply to a lot of things at once. But we don't want to lose, again, that sort of authenticity of making a more one-on-one approach where we get the emails in, people asking for our opinion on things or interviews. We want to be able to give them a voice to talk to rather than just a wall of text.
Isn't it true that as you grow bigger, you will have to rely more and more on that kind of blanket answering, though, just because of labour and that sort of thing?
I think where the Greens really felt down is that's exactly what they did, is they thought we're getting bigger now, so we're going to have to rely on party politics. We're going to have to rely on personalities. And I think one of the biggest things they pushed on, one of their big campaign slogans was, policies, not personalities. And that works as long as you don't heavily advertise your personalities. Instead, you show your policies. And they sort of, their taglines were saying one thing, but their practice was doing the other. And they had a lot of things from Caroline Lucas, a lot of things from Natalie Bennett, but people still didn't know who their local candidate was. So I think sort of on the big national levels, we can certainly use our sort of, if you like, heavy hitters to go to the BBC studios or talk to The Guardian or something like that. But you still have to retain on the local level, making sure people know who you are and making sure you've got time to talk to those people. And it's one of the biggest regrets, really, down here in where I was. I was hoping to meet the Green candidate. And when I turned up the night of the count, he was a paper candidate. He didn't turn up. And I think that resonated on a lot of the Green Party contested seats. And I was sort of a bit sorry for it.
I mean, it still is true that the Greens had a huge surge in terms of the votes, even if they didn't get the seats in the Commons to match that, though. So what do you think the future of the Green Party is? I mean, do you think that they're going to recede over the course of the next Parliament so they won't get so many votes? Or
I don't know. It's a bit of a bittersweet view I've got the Greens. In a lot of ways, I think they've got a lot of sensible policies. In a lot of ways, there was a candidate for the European Parliament, I think it was, called Andy Chiver, and he was a really solid candidate, really good guy, and I met him. Unfortunately, I think they're thinking more about how many votes they can win rather than what those votes really can become. When I was looking at the surge in membership, the last poll I saw of their membership, 50% of their members were ex-Liberal Democrats. So I think it's perhaps not so much as a sort of a green surge as it is an ex-yellow surge, where they've occupied a space that the Lib Dems have vacated, and that's what's boosted a lot of their membership. So I would, in some ways, and speaking to some of the candidates, is I'd really like them to, make that brand change of policies, not personalities, a more thorough, really bred through right into their DNA, because certainly down in Wales, it doesn't seem to have quite gripped in. If they can do that, then I can see a lot more people supporting them. The other thing is they seem to have muddled their personality a little bit, is that they've really adopted a very left-wing sort of socialist approach, and a lot of environmentalists first, whereas a lot of people in the Greens are socialists first and environmentalists second now. So it's created a bit of a sort of odd identity for the Greens.
Rounding off the interview, I wanted to know how Labour's move to the left under its new leader Jeremy Corbyn had affected the fates of the smaller parties, many of which have views similar to those championed by old Labour.
Well, with our sort of position on the spectrum, I certainly lean left more than I do any other direction, but there are other candidates and other people in the party that are perhaps a little more right. But on balance, the party tends to be quite centralist, and that seems to give us the approach of not caring so much whether it's a right or a left problem, or it's a socialist or a conservative or a capitalist, or whatever problem or solution label is mostly irrelevant. You want us to find something that actually is working or will work and respects the rights of the individual over the state. That tends to be the solution that people want, and then they tend to give it either a libertarian or a socialist or whatever label after. So trying to bend your policies to someone's personal view of a scale tends to be a little bit dangerous, if anything else. So we try and stay away from it, and more or less on balance we are centralist. There are those in the party, I would say, that like Jeremy Corbyn's sort of freshness, where again we haven't got that sort of salesman mentality, but like myself, there's a couple of policies of his, a lot of what he says I can agree with and make sense, and the way he approaches things I could certainly argue with him without feeling that my breath is being wasted. But there are some creeping policies in there that I still don't agree with, so I would be wary of anyone that says or portrays to be the solution to all our problems. Wait till they what they produce first, see what the results are, and then decide whether that's in line with sort of Pyrrhus policies or not.
The conventional wisdom on Fleet Street is that Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell are not doing a good job of leading the Labour Party in terms of inspiring the confidence of the public. Is that a view that you hold as well?
I say he's certainly done it, yes. I say he certainly rallied a lot of the public, both inside of his party and outside. I know the Greens, for quite some time, a lot of their forums and Facebook groups were absolutely littered with support for Jeremy Corbyn.
So you don't actually agree with the normal interpretation that Corbyn's not very good then?
No. I'd say he's, perhaps he's got a limited way of dealing with a problem, but that has seemed to have worked. Like he doesn't want to be the one that shouts over the ballot box. He doesn't want to be the one that makes sort of corny sly jokes and just sort of openly lies to sort of gain a sort of a win in a slagging out competition. So I would say overall, and certainly within terms of the eyes of the public, he is succeeding. But I wouldn't say that means he is definitely the solution to all our problems. And certainly when I look to Labour's history, a hugely to do with privacy as well, when they had that sort of whole ID cards suggestion, I wouldn't say he's a great fix for what we are campaigning on.
So that brings me to the end of my interview with David. I think he's an interesting guy, obviously knows a lot about the campaigning side of things, of being in a smaller party, much of which I thought was quite interesting. I'm not sure I agree with his interpretation of how effective Jeremy Corbyn is being as the new Labour leader, but I guess we'll see over the course of the next Parliament who's right. If you want to find out more information about the Pirate Party, you can go on their website. I think they're very interesting in terms of their handling of digital rights, which will certainly become more important to us, whether that translates into more votes for them or whether we'll see more focus on digital rights from the main Westminster parties also remains to be seen. But I hope you enjoyed this first foray into the fringe parties, and hopefully we'll do more interviews like this in the future at The Right Dishonourable. Thanks very much for listening.